as Russia effectively sanction-proofed its economy. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig. Good morning. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is meeting with Ukraine's president in Kiev as worries continue to grow about a potential Russian invasion of the Eastern European country. The meeting comes after American officials warn they believe Moscow could, quote, at any point launch an attack on Ukraine. For its part, Russia has denied the estimated 100,000 of its troops on the Ukrainian border are there to invade the country. Still, Ukraine's defense minister told the BBC his country needs more support from the West now.
I'm sure that the United States, United Kingdom, with European partners can make more for our defense. I mean, in economic sphere, like sanctions, and it could be done before the invasion, not after. Let's show to the Kremlin that you are seriously understand the all threats, and you can make this invasion very expensive for them.
But with divisions among NATO allies about how best to support Ukraine, is it likely that any form of economic sanctions would come before Russia takes action in Ukraine? No, says Keir Giles, a senior consulting fellow of the Russia and Eurasian program at think tank Chatham House.
That seems very unlikely, not just from the United States, but also we've heard from the EU today as well, that nobody is quite sure exactly what would trigger sanctions. It seems that Russia, in this respect, as in so many others, is winning, because when people are talking about sanctions, they're tying them to Russia actually invading Ukraine. But there is so much else that Russia could do, which wouldn't necessarily trigger those economic repercussions that are being threatened.
And Russia's finance minister has said that while sanctions would in fact be unpleasant for the country, it can cope with them. So really, how painful, if sanctions are imposed, will it be for Russia?
You can tell how effective sanctions really are by the fact that those demands to lift them increase in pitch and volume at the same time as Russia saying they're really not a problem at all. Now, let's not forget that some of the original sanctions that were set up in response to Russia's invasion of Crimea and the attack on eastern Ukraine were very specifically targeted at industries like oil extraction and the defense industry, in particular to try to blunt Russia's defense modernization program, which by then was well underway. So what Russia's undertaken is a program of import substitution, but also a mobilization of certain sectors of the economy, trying to make it more self-reliant.
I guess the question then becomes, would sanctions be effectively more painful for some Western countries, specifically European countries, that are reliant on Russia, for example, for things like oil and gas?
Well, that's the perpetual challenge. Now, Russia does have the stranglehold on Europe of actually controlling the energy supplies to countries like Germany. What's at stake is actually much bigger than that, because if European countries want to safeguard their sovereignty, then constraining Russia and reining in its ambition to regain control over the eastern half of the continent is a much bigger stake to play for.
Keir Giles from Chatham House, thanks so much for breaking this down for us.
Thank you.
Well, as those tensions continue to rise, Russia's currency, the ruble, hit a near two-week low today, though it's now moving slightly higher against the U.S. dollar. Checking some other numbers now. European stock markets are higher this morning. Benchmarks in Frankfurt, Paris, and Milan are up in the 0.2% to 0.6% range. London's FTSE 100, though, is little changed. That's after fresh data showed UK inflation hit a 30-year high of 5.4% in December from a year ago. That's pushing up expectations for a rate rise at the Bank of England's February meeting. Meanwhile, stocks across Asia ended solidly lower today. Shares of Sony plunged by almost 13% in Tokyo. The BBC's Andrew Wood explains why.
Sony may feel its latest PlayStation games machine is superior to Microsoft's Xbox, and its exclusive titles, such as Spider-Man, leave its rival behind. But Sony shareholders are clearly very worried by the way Microsoft has suddenly bulked up and become a much more serious competitor. It's buying Activision Blizzard for nearly $69 billion. Activision's games include blockbusters such as Call of Duty and World of Warcraft. Last year, Microsoft also bought another influential gaming company, Bethesda, for $7.5 billion. This latest deal means Microsoft is now number three player in computer games after Tencent of China and Sony. I'm the BBC's Andrew Wood for Marketplace.
To Beijing now, where a Winter Olympics official said today athletes will be punished if they engage in behavior against the spirit of the Games or Chinese rules. The event has been overshadowed by ongoing claims, which China denies, that it's committing genocide against some of its people in the Xinjiang region. But the BBC's Robin Brandt explains the area is hoping to benefit from Olympic events there.
This is Yao. He's describing a sunset behind him as he's holding a camera and snowboarding down a mountain. These sounds, this image of China, beautiful snow-covered slopes, is what you'll be seeing over the next few weeks. China's Communist Party leaders hope it will persuade millions to grab a board or boots and come here. But 29-year-old Yao isn't hurtling down a mountainside near the Olympic Games host city of Beijing. He is in Xinjiang.
What's the snow like? What's it like to ski there? What's the quality of the skiing and snowboarding like?
It's not windy in Xinjiang. It's very comfortable to ski here. The temperature here is not extremely low.
It's a place hoping for a major boom off the back of these games. It's a place where the US and others say China is carrying out a genocide.
It's all simply because of President Xi's one call to get 300 million Chinese people to ski. That's why the ski industry is taking off.
As China's second Olympics approach, images of horse-drawn sledges passing wooden huts in Xinjiang have featured in state media reporting here, almost as if it's part of the games. Drumming up tourism is crucial for the government's plan for the future of Xinjiang. It's very different to this, chanting in a classroom, which has featured in the BBC's reporting from Xinjiang over the last few years. It's reporting that's revealed mass indoctrination and incarceration of Chinese ethnic Muslims inside places that China used to deny even existed. China calls it anti-terror re-education. The US and others say it's part of a genocide. There are numerous firms lining up to sell you part of that alternative Xinjiang. The American snowboard pioneers Burton is one of them.
We've already seen in the last couple of years, we've seen, you know, triple-digit growth. So we're very excited about that.
This is Craig Smith. He's the chief executive of Burton China.
But again, we look at the business as secondary. What we really want to do is take care of the riders.
Burton has signed up a world-class Chinese boarder, and she isn't even a teenager yet. All of this is part of an effort to get more Chinese onto Burton's snowboards or into its gear. The company's planning dozens more stores here. It already operates in Xinjiang. But how does its presence and its plans in that region sit with a company ethos that's about being more than just a business?
We have two choices. We can either, you know, divorce ourselves from Xinjiang and just, you know, and say, no, we're not going to do anything out there. Or what we can do is we can try to understand what's going on in Xinjiang better. And, you know, yes, there may be some, you know, again, factually, I don't know. I'm not a politician. I've never studied any type of aspect
of that.
But have
you seen the media reports over the last couple of years?
Yeah, of course, everyone has, I believe so. But again, I divorce myself. What I mean by that is I can't change that. And we focus on what we can change.
Some would say maybe you can, actually.
Let's just go back to your statement here on the website. You want to affect positive change for our people, our factories, and create ripples.
Yes.
And maybe you can change things.
Yeah, well, hopefully for the better. Again, that's what I'm saying is, you know, what we'll focus on is what we can change for the better.
Burton is just one of numerous foreign firms who've decided that Xinjiang, the China market as a whole, is irresistible. Tesla and Volkswagen are much bigger names who operate there. Both have defended it, but also faced criticism for it. President Xi Jinping thinks his critics are politicizing his big sporting moment. His government says these Olympic Games should rise above politics. It's a distinction that some of the businesses looking to ride that Olympic wave want you to make as well.
That's the BBC's Robin Brandt reporting there. And in London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.